Court will proceed to the fifth case, Lexman versus Fine. Mr. Aldey.
May it please the court, my name is Craig Aldey. I represent the appellant, Randy Lechner. Randy Lechner was charged, convicted, and sentenced for two murders for causing one death. The Wisconsin Supreme Court found that the multiple homicide convictions for a single death did not violate double jeopardy. Mr. Lechner was sentenced to the maximum for both homicides to run consecutively, and also sentenced to the maximum to run consecutively on four other charges that arose out of the same vehicular accident. In sentencing Mr. Lechner to the maximum sentence, the trial court specifically referred to Mr. Lechner's four prior criminal convictions. In fact, Mr. Lechner only had one criminal conviction, as was demonstrated at the post-conviction motion hearing. The first issue I want to address is the inaccurate information at sentencing. Were it not for the error in the pre-sentence report indicating to the judge that Mr. Lechner had four prior criminal convictions, it would have been determined that he had one 15-year-old conviction that took place when he was a very young man, 19 or 20 years old. The court used the four criminal convictions that allegedly took place over a 10-year period to suggest, I think, that Mr. Lechner was a person of bad character, that he was incorrigible, that he presented a future danger to the public.
Even if you're correct and the judge made a mistake, why would that, I don't understand why that would be a violation of your client's federal constitutional rights.
Your Honor, I believe this case is quite similar to Tucker in the sense that
But that's using unconstitutional convictions to enhance the sentence. That raises obvious problems. But just a mistake, in sentencing, why is that a violation of the Constitution?
Well, I think the constitutional right that's at stake is recognized in Townsend and Tucker is the use of materially inaccurate information.
Well, that's a mistake. You're fancying it up by calling it materially inaccurate information. Suppose a judge makes a mistake in a sentence. Is that a violation of the Constitution?
I think this sort of mistake...
Why is this mistake any different from his misreading the statute and sentencing the person to 30 years when the maximum was 20 years?
I think this sort of mistake, that is an error in understanding the past criminal history, is important because in every sentence in Wisconsin, the judge is to take into account the character of the offender.
That's what maybe he violated Wisconsin law. What does that have to do with the Constitution?
Well, that is Wisconsin law that I was to refer to, but it's the inaccurate information that makes the difference. I don't think there's a sentencing in this country.
Well, a mistaken conviction is worse than a mistaken sentence, but that's not in itself a violation of the Constitution.
Well, I do believe the defendant is entitled to be sentenced on an accurate factual foundation.
Well, that's of course the ideal, but I don't see what constitutional right you're hooking it to.
Again, Your Honor, I guess I go back to Townsend and to Tucker, in which I believe the court held that the reliance on inaccurate information
it's one thing to use an unconstitutional conviction to enhance a person's sentence. It's another thing to simply make a mistake about a defendant's criminal history, which probably happens quite frequently.
Well, with all due respect, I do think that the problem is similar to using, for example, in Tucker, I guess, with uncounseled convictions, in that the court assumes that the defendant engaged in conduct sufficient to result in a criminal conviction and said something
about
his
character. If his prior conviction was unconstitutional because he didn't have counsel, and now you use that conviction to enhance his sentence, you're diluting his right to counsel. But I don't think you're diluting any constitutional right when you just have a situation where a judge has made a mistake about someone's criminal history.
I don't know that this is the judge's mistake. I'm not pointing a finger at the judge for making the error.
But it
seems to me that few things are as important in the evaluation of a defendant at sentencing.
Few things are as important as guilt and innocence, but an erroneous conviction is not a violation of the Constitution.
I guess at this point, all I can say is I respectfully disagree. I do believe that inaccurate information is what's at stake in Tucker and Townsend, Your Honor.
What happened at the post-conviction hearing, Mr. Holliday? There was a post-conviction hearing in this case, right?
Correct.
Before the same judge?
Yes.
And this was brought to his attention?
Yes.
And so... Did he not then, in recognizing that there was an inaccuracy originally, still separate out and still say that the same sentence would stand, even though recognizing now that it can't be based on four convictions?
I think Your Honor has accurately summarized what occurred at that hearing. I would submit that what Mr. Lechner should have been allowed to do is actually have a resentencing and to present to the court the perspective regarding what had happened in those incidents, because the judge was under the assumption, well, this conduct rose to such a level that there was a finding of guilt in a criminal case. There wasn't much point in the defendant disputing it or trying to minimize what occurred in those
incidents. You're speaking about the circumstances of the various arrests, is that it?
Correct.
Right.
And I don't think we're asking for any extraordinary relief here. I mean, I think it's simply fair to give to Mr. Lechner the opportunity to address the court and explain what occurred in those instances and suggest why it does matter that he wasn't convicted of a crime, and that Mr. Lechner can go into the fact that over a 15-year period, most of his adult life, he was crime-free.
Did he seek to do that at the post, or why didn't he seek to do just that at when he had the post-conviction opportunity?
I don't think it's an appropriate issue at the post-conviction motion hearing. I don't think you make an assumption that I'm going to be resentenced here, and here's all the information.
Isn't that what he was really seeking?
It is, and if the court had said, I expected him to do, to say, yes, this was inaccurate, and of course I considered the criminal history like I would in every single case. Resentencing is appropriate on that basis. Then additional information would have been presented. But for the purpose of whether there was a basis for resentencing, that information was extraneous.
Well, but you always have to show prejudice in a post-conviction hearing. You have to show that, you know, it's extraordinary relief. You have to show that if you're resentenced, you know, there's a shot. You have a shot at a shorter sentence.
Well, I don't know that it's exactly prejudice, Your Honor. If he has established that he's sentenced on an inaccurate foundation, what Tucker would state as well.
No, it doesn't. I mean, what if the mistake is that his birthday was stated incorrectly? That would be immaterial.
I guess that.
So that these are material errors because his criminal history really isn't that bad.
I agree. They have to be material errors. I don't think you have to convince the judge at that moment that he would, in fact, give a different sentence.
What was he accused of in those things that he was not, for which he was not convicted?
They were domestic related, a disorderly conduct and a battery.
Was there some anything alcohol related or drug related?
The judge made that assumption, for example, in the second offense, that he would have been exposed to alcohol treatment in the program. In fact, that was part of Mr. Lechner's post-conviction affidavit, saying, I didn't receive any alcohol treatment in that program, despite the judge's assumption to the contrary.
So by not receiving it, he didn't have an alcohol problem? Is that what the implication is?
Obviously, I mean, given what occurred, I think there are some alcohol alcohol issues, but it was not something that anybody had sent him to treatment for or suggested this was a significant problem that was apparent.
Charlie, even if we were to agree with you about somehow some baseline unfairness, it's a habeas situation, and is there no reasonable way one could accept the position taken by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in this case?
I think their decision is contrary to Tucker in that in Tucker, the court addressed the question essentially, is there still a due process violation if the conduct, if the activity underlying the criminal conviction would justify the sentence regardless of whether there was a conviction?
Right.
And the answer in Tucker was, yes, it is still a due process violation. The Wisconsin Supreme Court answered no, and I would suggest that that's contrary to Tucker, or at least an unreasonable application of.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Albee. Mr. Weber?
Good morning. Excuse me. May it please the court, my name is Greg Weber. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin. Answering the judge's question regarding the nature of the original offenses of arrest, the incorrect information in the pre-sentence investigation report, those offenses are described in greater detail at footnote 14 of the Wisconsin Supreme Court's opinion, which is found in the answer that we filed to the petition for habeas corpus. We move our argument on the double jeopardy issue. On brief, I'll respond to the points made by counsel on the sentencing claim. The reality of the situation is that we are in fact talking about a mistake, and not a mistake of constitutional dimension, in the information that was received by the sentencing court. The mistake in sentencing in this matter occurred in the context of the state circuit court judge's summary of other accurate information that constituted what the judge considered to be warning signs of which Mr. Lechner should have been aware. The district court, in fact, considered the possibility that this was not information, misinformation, of constitutional dimension. The district court eventually resolved this issue under 2254, finding that the state court's decision was not erroneous and was a reasonable application of U.S. Supreme Court precedent.
I'd like to ask you about the double jeopardy. I don't understand the theory under which he gets a heavier sentence because he happens to be guilty of two equivalent crimes, the second degree reckless homicide and vehicular homicide. Why does that merit a heavier sentence?
I don't know that I understand what you mean. Two sentences for two different convictions being a heavier sentence?
Yeah, you got a heavier sentence because of these two, yes.
I don't see a problem with that given
the fact. What's the point? I understand the point. What did he do worse than if he'd just been criminally reckless?
Each statute under which he was convicted represents a
what's the penal philosophy for punishing him more? I mean, suppose he had been drunk and he had been riding a horse and he recklessly trampled and killed someone. Then you couldn't use the vehicular statute, I assume.
A horse is not a vehicle under Wisconsin law.
And, maybe he killed someone with his pit bull or something like that. So you just get him under the criminal recklessness statute. So what is the point of punishing him more severely because he happened to be driving?
Because the two statutes at issue, the two criminal statutes, each vindicate a separate group of legitimate state interests. The reckless homicide statute goes to behavior that fits the classification of recklessness under Wisconsin law. The vehicular homicide statute addresses the very real danger posed by drunken drivers on Wisconsin roads. The legislature has decided that this particular conduct falls within the ambit of two separate statutes, each of which vindicate a separate set of legitimate state interests.
They have the same punishment apart from this sort of detail about the losing your license or what have you. to say that the same conduct, I don't understand. It's not... I don't see the element of aggravation because it was a car rather than a pit bull or a horse.
The level of risk posed by a drunken driver on a road generally exposes a high number of innocent people to death or injury. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has called it manifestly antisocial behavior in State versus KBOC.
In this situation, if there's a homicide, if a person is driving drunk and another person runs a red light and is killed, is the person who had the green light but was nevertheless drunk while driving, is that a violation?
I'm trying to remember if that particular statute contains an affirmative defense of the accident having...
The only reason I'm asking that is obviously that person wasn't necessarily... They could have been driving in a perfectly straight line within the speed limit and the green light just happened to be totally drunk.
I think
there are some states that have that. That's why I'm trying to distinguish, put a chasm between the two statutes, if there is such a thing, so that there's some legislative purpose for doing that.
I know that the homicide by reckless conduct statute, I may be misunderstanding your question, has an affirmative defense built into it, I believe, that allows for mitigation of liability if the accident would have happened in any set of circumstances, even though the driver was drunk. But I think I may be missing your question.
Well, I guess you are, because second-degree reckless homicide, I assume, is where you're just driving recklessly and crash into somebody.
Second-degree reckless homicide, by definition, is very basic. Whoever recklessly causes the death of another human being and then criminal recklessness...
There's no intoxication necessary.
No.
Whereas the other one, homicide by intoxicated use of a vehicle.
All right. Okay, the block...
What I'm saying is, could a homicide by intoxicated use of a vehicle not involve reckless driving?
Right. In terms of the Blockberger analysis, that's the differentiation between... One of the differentiations between the two statutes. Homicide by intoxicated use requires intoxication and use of a motor vehicle. Second-degree reckless homicide does not. Second-degree reckless homicide requires that the act causing death be criminally reckless. Criminal recklessness is not limited exclusively to situations where an individual might be driving impaired. If there are no other questions, I thank the court.
All right. So I'll be, your time is expired, but you may have a minute for rebuttal.
As to the two homicides for a single death, the legislature, in enacting 939-66 sub 2, specifically intended to prohibit, by the language, a homicide and a less serious homicide. At no point during these proceedings has the state or any court submitted any reason why the legislature would seek to allow multiple homicide punishments in the instance where the punishments happen to be equal rather than less serious. Going to your point, Judge Posner, if the state found it necessary to punish in addition because somebody was drunk, for example, rather than reckless, it seems to me that a simple first-time OWI would satisfy that purpose. The reason the penalties are so high is to punish for the harm that's caused, the death. And that's the 10-year punishment. Once that's imposed to compensate for the single death, then you might want to punish for the antisocial act of driving drunk, but you shouldn't have those kind of aggravated penalties, I think, added to the first aggravated penalty. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Albee, court extends a special thanks to you for accepting this appointment and ably representing Mr. Lechner. Case is taken under advisement.